Hi everyone, it's great to be back with the final episode of Season 1 of The Infinite City. Before we get started, just a heads up that this podcast will be live later this month in a special recording as part of the Open House Belfast Festival and the Belfast International Arts Festival. It's going to be on Sunday, the 21st of October at the Sonic Arts Research Centre, and if you'd like to join us, tickets are on sale now from placeni.org/events. Stay tuned for more details at the end of this episode. This is The Infinite City, stories from Belfast of people and place. I'm Connor McCafferty.
And I'm Rebecca McCabe. Today we're exploring a lesser-known chapter in the tumultuous history of housing in Belfast. Marianne Elliott, a retired professor of history, walks us through the place she grew up.
The estate in North Belfast where Marianne's family lived was built as part of a radical experiment in social housing. Its successes and its failures hold important lessons for a city still struggling with how to build a shared future.
In the opening chapter of her memoir, Hearthlands, Marianne quotes the artist, Colin Middleton.
Place is everything. When you get there, you know you belong. You know your kith and kin. Coming up this morning, up the Antrim Road, and seeing the Cahill as we were ascending, I just felt a huge rush of excitement that I was home. And I haven't lived here for some 50 years, but it still feels like home to me.
A few miles north of the city centre, Cahill rises abruptly over Belfast.
The Cahill dominates Belfast, but in particular this part of North Belfast as you're ascending up towards the castle in Bellevue. And there's a very, very steep escarpment of 500 feet, and then there's a sharp drop right down to the shoreline.
In 1947, hundreds of new houses began to appear on a 31-acre site at the foot of the upper part of the hill off the Antrim Road. These new houses raked gently down the slope, nestled underneath the hill and facing out to Belfast Lock.
Which is what makes it so special in terms of scenery. It's absolutely quite amazing. There were views over Belfast Lock and the Hollywood Hills from our house, in front of our house, and from the back of the house you looked straight into MacArt's Fort and the Belfast Castle. So you were living in paradise land, even though this was essentially social housing.
This is the Whitewell Estate, also known to some locals as the White City. It was one of 11 new social housing estates to be built on the outskirts of Belfast in the 1940s and 1950s.
The arrival of the estate would bring about a change in the demographics of what was one of the wealthiest areas of Belfast.
It was built between 1947 and 1949. And it's built in this area that had been, as I say, one of the richest areas of Belfast. And suddenly you've got working class housing coming into a plush middle class suburb.
Although the new houses in the White City were clearly distinct from the luxurious old villas that surrounded them, they were still generous in space and proportion. They were constructed from prefab Orlett concrete, an innovative technology that emerged in the 1940s. The Orlett panels were made in factories and delivered for assembly, allowing for fast construction on site.
New residents would find in the estate and in their new homes a sense of space, brightness and newness. Standard housing density in Belfast at the time was 60 homes to an acre. The White City had only 10 homes per acre.
The streets of the White City followed a new trend for distinctive naming that was a feature of estates built at that time. In the Craiga Estate in East Belfast, for example, streets were named after Northern Ireland's rivers. New streets on the Falls were named after mountains. The residents of the White City would live on streets named after lochs. Marianne's family lived on Portmore Hill, named after a loch in South Antrim.
Portmore Hill was the longest street on the estate. Because their house was one of the last to be built, her family had a huge garden that abutted the grounds of the surviving villas. Feeding their neighbours' horses was just one of the perks of living on Portmore Hill. Another was its dramatic topography.
The great thing about Portmore Hill was, as you can imagine, the name Hill, it ran from the top of the estate to the bottom of the estate. It was the same gradient as this. I had an older brother before my sisters came along. I was always a bit of a tomboy. And they all had these things called guiders, which nowadays we call go-karts. They built them from old kind of, you know, and we'd start at the top of the hill and kind of, you know, go right down. And the same with kind of roller skates and everything, you know, for mother. And in the winter, just, you know, it was turned into really a kind of an ice rink.
For those who called the White City home, the setting provided beautiful scenery. This was a welcome provision for many of its new residents, who were relocating from run-down terraced housing in the tightly packed streets of Belfast city centre. The steep inclines that enabled those expansive views created distinctive infrastructure to connect the estate with the main thoroughfare of the Antrim Road.
We've just entered the Antrim Road end of the White City estate, and you'd find it hard to believe that there is an estate built just over the trees. This is called the Snaky Path. And when I was a child, it already had the name, although sometimes we called it the Wriggly Path. And you can see why, because this path is coming down from just below the Cave Hill from the Antrim Road, and it goes right down to the Whitewell Road. So it's very, very steep. So it has to go in, you know, very sharp contours all the way down, so snaky or wriggly. Nowadays, it's a bit more manicured. It's got walls, whereas it didn't when I was growing up. There was a little bit of tarmac, but sometimes kind of rough. And so us children, you know, we would start running from the top, you know, and just more or less bouncing right down to the bottom. Whereas I've got descriptions from people who were adults there saying how hard it was in the winter because this used to freeze over, and they were walking up to the buses, which we didn't notice. We thought it was great. You know, back when I was growing up, there would have been more trees. I mean, I remember there was one of the big trees here, and we had a huge swing off it, you know. I mean, the dangerous things we used to get up to. And there's kind of a little river down the side of it. So you can already see some of the magical landscapes. And this is where every day in my young life I would come up here and come down here to catch buses to school.
The design of the White City, like other estates being built around the edge of Belfast in the late 1940s and early 50s, was still heavily influenced by the principles of Victorian philanthropy. Key to those principles was the promotion of open space and gardens as the setting for social housing.
For children of Marianne's generation, those amenities offered the kind of idyllic childhood that would have been impossible for working class children in Belfast even a decade earlier.
And it was so safe. You know, you'd kind of stay out till dark, you know, and you'd be kind of, we'd be building houses in the forest, we'd be running around, you know, Bellevue and the castle, and it was just, it was extraordinary. It was like having a gigantic private estate all to yourself and your friends. You still get a little bit of the sense, you know, and the forest itself was just, you know, absolutely magical. You know, we would be building tree houses, and, you know, I remember there was a little rivulet down there, and there was a huge tree that had fallen down, and we turned it, that was at a stage. There was a slightly older guy used to come with us. He was lovely, actually. He was a guitarist. He was a bit older than all of us. But he had a ready-made audience of all the children, and he'd kind of sit up with his guitar on this tree, you know, and kind of strum away, you know, playing all the kind of, you know, it was absolutely magical. And we'd all, you know, everybody was dressing up in those days, you know, cowboys and Indians and God knows what else, and just running around, you know. And, you know, I don't remember parents being that worried about us, you know. And when you get to the spring, the wild flowers that start coming through here, you know, there's lots of wild iris because it's so damp, and the primroses. And when you get to May, those lovely wild roses just all over the place. So, you know, it was just absolutely magical, you know.
Despite Marianne's enchanted childhood, the estate was not completely removed from the social and political realities of Northern Ireland. For children, then as now, the division between Catholic and Protestant people manifests in one very important way.
Now, although it was a mixed estate, Northern Ireland education then and now it still is religiously divided, unfortunately. And in the mid-1950s, two primary schools were built at each side of the estate. And most of my friends went to them. But because I came from a Catholic family, we were all bussed into the Newington area for primary school. And my brother, who was a bit older at one stage, had to bus up to Glengormley. So, you know, that's why the snaky path, or the wriggly path, sometimes I called it, became so central to my upbringing. And I look back now and think, why didn't I think it was odd that we weren't going to the schools that we... At the bottom of the snaky path now, there's an integrated primary school. It was called the Throne School so it was a state school when it existed from the middle of the 1950s. And really, this is the one that, you know, if there'd been proper shared education that I should have gone to, it would have been magical. I would have walked out my front door and been in the school in about 3 minutes. It's nice to know that this estate that I grew up in, it is flanked now by two integrated schools.
The history of the White City is fascinating as a snapshot of Northern Irish society in the post-war period, but it's also a history of the Northern Ireland Housing Trust. From 1945 until 1971, the Housing Trust built and maintained almost 50,000 new dwellings across Northern Ireland. Within its first decade, it built 11 new social housing estates around Belfast. White City was the first to be completed.
The Housing Trust was addressing the desperate underprovision of homes across Northern Ireland. In Belfast, the Blitz of 1941 had created an urgent need for housing.
56,000 buildings were damaged or destroyed during World War II bombings in Belfast. This loss led to rampant homelessness and an unprecedented housing crisis in a city that was already struggling to house its residents.
The Northern Ireland government's record in building social housing after Northern Ireland was established in 1921 was absolutely appalling. Working class housing was already dire, absolutely dire. And added to that, then the Blitz, particularly in Easter Tuesday 1941, North Belfast was one of the worst hit areas, the working class areas of North Belfast. The whole of the Antrim Road, there was hardly a house that wasn't damaged. The descriptions of the Blitz in this area are absolutely heartbreaking. People were living homeless, you know, on the sides of the Cave Hill, partly to avoid the bombing, but also because their places had been destroyed. So the housing crisis in Belfast at the end of World War II was one of the worst in the two islands.
The other nations of the UK were progressing social housing agendas as early as 1918. But Northern Ireland was paralysed by the prejudices of its ruling class. Belfast Corporation, the body responsible for social housing, tended to see private enterprise as the solution to the housing crisis. In this regard, Belfast was wildly out of step with its British neighbours, who looked on in confusion as public money was used not for public housing, but to subsidise private development.
By 1944, the first official report on housing in Northern Ireland would note that nearly half of the houses in Belfast's county borough needed extensive repair, and more than a quarter were either totally unfit or overcrowded.
It was reckoned in 1944 to 1945, that Belfast was in urgent need of 100,000 houses right away. Where were they going to get 100,000 houses?
The situation was desperate for many families, and it crossed sectarian lines. For a time, the communities of Belfast were united in outrage at the conditions in which families were forced to live.
In the spring of 1945, 30,000 people took to the streets, marching through the city of Belfast to demand action on the housing crisis. Later that same year, the Northern Ireland Housing Trust was established.
The then Unionist government decided to set up essentially an NGO called the Housing Trust, totally separate from the councils, because contrary to to opinion and perceptions. There was really very bad feeling between the Stormont Unionist government and the local councils in Northern Ireland. So the Housing Trust was set up separately and independently funded from the councils to urgently build working class housing.
The Trust was established as a public authority with a lot of freedom. Its ambition was to resolve decades of inaction and neglect in the delivery of homes across Northern Ireland. To do this, it needed an extensive team and quickly became a major employer. It seconded almost 2,000 managers from other government bodies and hired 600 architects, 500 accountants, 320 registrars, 150 shorthand typists, 101 regular typists, and 135 clerical assistants.
The Trust had ambitious targets. They wanted to build 25,000 homes across Northern Ireland within their first decade. The Trust was empowered by a devolved government that was itself frustrated with the housing record of local councils, which up to then were the only provider of public housing in Northern Ireland. The government assured the Housing Trust that any approvals it needed would be treated with the highest priority. And so, within 18 months of being established, the Trust had begun work on more than 14 sites across Northern Ireland.
In Belfast, they had to build the housing outside the Belfast boundaries, because inside the Belfast boundaries, that was under the control of Belfast Corporation. And that's why you suddenly get working class houses starting to creep up the hills on the outskirts of Belfast. And the estate that I've written about and that we're talking about, the White City, was one of these. It was one of the first housing trust estates to be built.
To build on the sprawling land at the foot of Cave Hill, the Trust needed to acquire the 31 acres from its private owners. It did this by using controversial compulsory purchase powers. The vesting order went into effect on the 5th of February 1946, and the White City's construction began. Construction of the original 322 White City homes was completed in March 1949.
No wonder we felt privileged, and no wonder the people who are already here were rather resentful, because the land on which the White City was built was acquired through vesting orders, which is compulsory purchase, and we're just about to walk past the area on the Antrim Road that would have been full of small villas, and understandably the owners of these villas and the huge gardens and everything were up in arms about this, but it was compulsory purchase, and so they lost their land. There's one or two of them still remaining.
The decision to build the White City in such a picturesque location embodied the Housing Trust's radical idea that social housing should be beautiful housing.
The Housing Trust board were almost entirely Quaker business people. They weren't paid, so old-fashioned Victorian philanthropy is at the back of these estates. And these estates were built all over Northern Ireland by the Housing Trust very, very successfully. They took a lot of their ideas from the Victorian philanthropists that had built kind of idealised towns for working class in England. The idea was that environment and place was as important as the actual house. And so the plan of this estate is amazing. The original plan, there's so much green space in it. And that's why it was such an Arcadia for us children. There was greenery everywhere.
The majority of homes in the White City had three bedrooms and had a bathroom and a separate toilet. Their interior spaces matched their exterior in terms of quality. In her memoir, Marianne fondly remembers the built-in wardrobes in the two largest bedrooms. They were large enough, she says, for the children to play hide and seek and the parents to hide the Christmas presents.
Marianne spent a colourful childhood on the estate. Red, yellow and green doors set against the white rendering of the exterior walls were a common feature in the White City. To keep things looking fresh, the Housing Trust employed painters, among them the Irish writer Brendan Behan. The painting teams would diligently repaint the doors every 4 years.
The tenants themselves were responsible for maintaining the interior of the homes. Most were brightly coloured as well, with yellow paint on the walls and maroon embossed wallpaper matching the maroon suite, which was a standard fixture in most homes. The kitchen walls were papered with pictures of vegetables and cooking utensils, and a yellow formica kitchen table and chairs accented the room.
And people who moved into this estate had been, you know, virtually homeless, certainly living in places where often there was no running water. My own parents had a dilapidated cottage with two infants in County Down with no running water and no inside facilities. This is one of the things I was talking to people, the stories of where they came from. And the one thing that was coming out was just how wonderful to have an indoor toilet and bathroom. And one man told me that when his mother moved in, the relatives would come over from largely the Sandy Row area every Sunday to have baths, essentially.
This model of quality social housing with considerable space and modern amenities pushed up against a culture of conservatism which was dominant in Northern Ireland at the time.
Providing residents with indoor bathrooms, considered by some to be luxuries, proved particularly contentious when the bill that created the Housing Trust was being debated in Stormont. Unionist Senator J.G. Leslie found the whole idea morally suspect. He criticised the trust as a utopian scheme and expressed disdain for housing estates he saw as elaborate pleasure gardens.
But the Housing Trust did not allocate these coveted homes to just anyone on the social housing list. There was a process to undergo and criteria to meet before you would be offered a Housing Trust home.
The Housing Trust in the initial estates it was building were very picky about their tenants. They handpicked them. And it's well known that when they went in for the preliminary visit, they did look around to see whether the housewife was a good housekeeper, whether these houses were clean, and they would check up on the employment. So in many ways, these estates were for respectable workers. They didn't even use the term working class. They used the term worker, respectable, you know, aspiring. The Housing Trust estates were recognised as a cut above council estates. You did have to prove that you could pay the rent. You know, like if you'd been long-term unemployed, you probably wouldn't have got a house here, OK? You would have got a council house. So they were reckoned to be, you know, much better. But at the same time, the Housing Trust realised that, you know, there was a level, because the rents were higher, they were always kind of combating the level of rates to try and keep them down. And there was, I think it was in the early 50s, I came across lots of correspondence they have with both the government and Belfast. And they were, and what they were saying was, look, the materials in the White City aren't as good as in Craigie, and yet they're paying the same rates. I mean, Craigie bathrooms have proper tiles, and the White City doesn't. And the answer was, no, but the White City has got more space and much nicer surrounds, therefore it'll pay the same rates. But just look at this.
As well as investing in the people who lived in the houses, the Housing Trust also invested in those who worked to maintain them. Managing the upkeep of the estates were the housing managers, all of whom were women.
And don't forget, this is the 1940s. All the housing managers of the estates were female. I mean, what a career opportunity at a time when, you know, there weren't many professions open to women. And these women were, once they were recruited, they were sent over to various places in Scotland and in England, where this idea the idea of the of how to run, how to build a community, essentially. They were very keen on that. It wasn't just a place, it was building a kind of a sense of belonging.
The role of housing manager was a huge innovation for Northern Ireland. They were extensively trained professionals, and their roles involved business accountancy, housing maintenance, and construction methods, as well as the personal skills required for a lot of contact with tenants.
Housing managers' day-to-day duties on the job included rent collection, advising housewives on budget management, and supporting them to maintain their house and make the most of the modern conveniences they'd been provided with.
The housing managers often decided who should get a housing trust home, and they were responsible for the initial visit to vet applicants on the housing list. Marianne recounts her family's first encounter with the housing manager.
The housing manager came out, and they came unannounced purposely. You know, but they came unannounced. So she turned up, and my mother was washing nappies in a big tin bath in the middle of a field with a washing board. You know, and the woman probably thought, well, this young mother probably does need a house. And my mother, she was telling me about this not long before she died. So she was late 80s, you know, or 90. And she said to me, if I'd known she was coming, I would have cleaned the cottage. You know. And once they'd been approved for a house, they got the house within a matter of weeks.
The housing managers were instrumental in creating and maintaining a sense of community in the Housing Trust estates. Based on what's known as the Octavia Hill system, pride of place was based on mutual responsibility.
The tenants, on the one hand, were responsible for their rent and for the care of their individual homes. The trust, via the housing managers, reciprocated by ensuring the scrupulous upkeep of the estate. They quickly responded to requests for repairs and maintained personal relationships through weekly visits to tenants.
The completion of the White City coincided with the birth of the British welfare state, and the residents of the estate settled into a decade of calm prosperity. Housing was allocated on the basis of need first, and then the ability to pay the higher rents. It was a community that was mixed both in social class and in religious background.
All their estates were mixed religion. They were awarded on a series of points, and need was the main issue, you know, regardless of your religion. This was mixed. I worked out that maybe about between 25 and 30% of this estate, which is now a largely Protestant estate, but 25 to 30%, when I was growing up, we were Catholics. So it was mixed, and all the estates were. There were complaints. Back in the 1950s, there were complaints from the loyal orders that these estates, so many of the houses were going to Catholics. But even the unionist government stood up against the loyal orders, supported the housing trust, yeah. These early estates would have been, yeah, filled with kind of a very interesting mixture. I've done an analysis largely from street directories, because the street directories give you the occupation. And in the early years of the White City, because of the housing shortage, there was a real mix. There was professional people as well as working class people, skilled tradespeople. There were policemen, there were civil servants. I found a police inspector living here. You know, there was quite a mix.
This mix held relatively stable for the best part of a decade. But even extensive building by the Trust couldn't meet the demand for housing across the city. Thousands of people were still living in slum conditions in the terraces of Belfast's inner city neighbourhoods.
No one could have foreseen the half century of turmoil that was to follow, nor the undoing of the work of the Housing Trust. The White City estate had been constructed in the late 1940s in a spirit of political optimism and idealism. Housing for workers would be allocated to those most in need. Housing would be shared. Workers could expect homes that would not just accommodate their families, but that would provide comfort, light, space and air, surrounded by a green, open environment.
In 1998, 36 years after her family had moved out, Marianne returned to the White City with her mother to find their old street, Portmore Hill.
That time when we came back, I was looking round. I said, Mum, this should be the beginning of Portmore Hill. What's happening? And two ladies came past. I said, where's Portmore Hill nowadays? And she said, you're standing on it. And we were standing on rubble. The houses in the White City started to go wrong quite early because they discovered in the Orlett construction there was a terrible fault because they were essentially cement houses and they were factory built and there was something in the concrete construction that corroded the steel. So the steel frames were corroding from quite an early part. It was in the 1980s that the tenants started to complain about the standard. They'd really gone down badly by then. And the housing executive that had taken over the housing trust started to investigate just improving them. And that's when they really discovered you couldn't improve them because the structure was more or less had been eaten away. And so they started a programme of progressively demolishing and rebuilding. Now, the modern houses in the White City are absolutely beautiful. I've been inside quite a number of them, and I just think, you know, these are so superior to the ones that I grew up in. But they took an awful long time to rebuild. I mean, they were rebuilding them from the late 80s right through to the mid-90s. People were being moved around. You know, as the houses were being rebuilt that they were going to get moved in, they were being moved into the kind of ones that were condemned. So the housing conditions were awful.
In the time since Marianne had grown up in the estate, it had transformed not only physically but also socially. The mixed character of the neighbourhood had all but disappeared. Along the Serpentine Road, a peace wall had been constructed in 1998 to separate the now predominantly Protestant White City from the more Catholic areas alongside it.
It's hard to pin down a direct cause for the demise of the original White City. Belfast was undergoing dramatic changes. In 1964, the Matthew Plan recommended development that would decentralise Belfast and disperse its population. In housing terms, this meant the demolition of much of the city's dense, terraced neighbourhoods and the relocation of their residents to the suburbs and new towns.
Finding suitable land was an issue. As a solution, underdeveloped sites within Housing Trust estates were identified. An agreement between the Trust and Belfast Corporation saw families from the council housing list accommodated in relets within the White City, and the construction of 12 new houses. Although the ability to pay the higher trust rents was still a requirement, the housing managers had to overlook some of their criteria in granting tenancies. The makeup of the estates slowly began to change.
New council estates were constructed around the White City too. Their completion coincided with rising sectarian tensions in Northern Ireland. By the end of the 1960s, these tensions had escalated into armed conflict that would go on for almost 30 years. This had an enormous impact on the configuration of communities.
I mean, Belfast during the Troubles had one of the largest enforced movement of population in the whole of Europe since World War II. Just people kind of fleeing for safety into ghetto areas of their religion. If you look at the kind of sectarian map of the area, because North Belfast had been so mixed, and traditionally people in working class areas don't like to move far, and Belfast is very noted for families wanting to stay together. So when the Troubles happened, they didn't move very far. That's why you've got so many interfaces in North Belfast.
Rather than move away, communities found safety by turning inwards, creating a mosaic of single identity communities side by side, often kept apart by peace walls and other spatial interventions.
The development of regional infrastructure also played a role in dividing communities, whether intentional or not.
They planned this estate and their other estates so that there would be no through traffic and that it would be safe for children. And the streets were kind of staggered. And you've got an example of it here. The houses weren't directly onto the road. But what happened was they built the North Approach Road in 1955, which was the road that kind of destroyed a lot of the old communities down around the Ox Street area and started destroying this area. So this estate had only been finished 6 years. That area that is now the motorway had again been all fields. There was a GAA a Gaelic athletic club just here called the Wolf Tone Club, and they had the fields, the Gaelic field, but the children from the whole area used them, and they also used, they would go to the social events, they'd go to learn Irish dancing, Protestants and Catholics alike, and the other halls, you know, people would use them. So the GAA fields, the local lads would go and play football and everything. And they lost that. In 1955, that was lost.
As the motorway cut its path alongside the Whitewell Road and land was lost to it, the character of the area also changed. The loss of shared space exacerbated social changes happening within the White City.
The new tenants moving in were largely from single-identity neighbourhoods, where the display of sectarian emblems was commonplace. In the context of shared housing, however, such overt expressions of community identity were new and for many residents unwelcome.
Although eventually it did become not entirely Protestant, but almost entirely because of the Troubles, it didn't fall apart as early as, you know, some of the other places, you know, in West and East Belfast. The 1971 census, so we're into the Troubles, but not the worst yet. There was 23% of Catholics still living in the White City. By 1991, there was only 5%, and they were largely original people that had moved in between 47 and 49. And when I was writing my book, I learned that there was only about three or four of them left, and they were very elderly and starting to go into dementia. But certainly until, you know, from the late 40s up until the mid-1970s, it had been totally mixed.
What happened in the White City, particularly the loss of mix in terms of residents, was mirrored in estates and neighbourhoods across Northern Ireland. During the period of the Troubles, areas became less mixed and more divided.
Old inequalities in the allocation of housing had never gone away, but they became more marked. When the British government established an investigation into the causes of the civil unrest and what could be done to resolve it, housing reform became a major issue.
The government's investigation, known as the Cameron Commission, was set up in 1969. The commission recognised that housing discrimination on the basis of religion had contributed to the outbreak of unrest. It recommended policy reform to make housing allocation fairer.
The housing trust very unfairly got caught up in the Cameron Commission that criticised, you know, all the councils and the housing allocation. And the housing trust wasn't like that, but it kind of got caught up in it because of the Cameron Commission was sacked in 1969. The housing executive was set up then the following year, I think, and housing was taken away from all the local councils and also the housing trust, which was a great shame because the housing trust was independent.
The trust has not been without its critics. Some have argued that its policies reinforced long-standing structural inequalities. For example, its strict selection process and higher than average rent might have indirectly excluded Catholics who were less likely to be employed in higher paid professions. But it did not display the kind of direct discrimination witnessed in local council housing.
Nonetheless, the Housing Trust finally succumbed to social and political pressure in 1971, when the new housing executive was established that year to take over social housing functions from local government. It also subsumed the trust.
And one of the reasons that I wrote this book, I'd wanted to tell the story over the whole of Northern Ireland, but that was a really big project. And see, I was very conscious of the people who had moved into these new estates after the war were dying and going into Alzheimer's. I was very conscious that, you know, their memory was dying with them.
The history of the Housing Trust is profoundly important to tell. The problems the Trust addressed haven't gone away, and we continue to ask the questions that it was trying to answer, mainly, how can we live together? Shared estates remain far from the norm, and Belfast is still in the midst of a housing crisis with thousands of people living in unsuitable or substandard housing.
The Housing Trust attempted from the late 1940s to build shared, mixed communities. It followed clear principles that would ensure the dignity of good housing for working people. Its houses were designed to a high quality using modern techniques. Estates were constructed holistically, and the whole setting was as important as the individual houses.
As well as its physical infrastructure, the Trust also implemented social infrastructure. It created support for people transitioning into an unfamiliar environment, and it actively tried to create neighbourhoods and neighbourliness.
Though ultimately undone by the very issues it sought to address, the Housing Trust attempted to break down the barriers that keep the two biggest communities of Northern Ireland apart. It made efficient use of a brief period in time when this outcome was politically possible.
For more on the history of the Housing Trust and of the White City, you can read Marianne Elliott's memoir, Hearthlands, which was published in 2017 by Blackstaff Press.
This was the final episode of Season 1 of The Infinite City. From all of us on the team, we want to thank you for listening and for sharing your thoughts and feedback with us over the past few months.
So Season 1 is over. While you wait for Season 2, you can get your Infinite City fix on Sunday, the 21st of October 2018, when we produce our first ever live show as part of the Belfast International Arts Festival. If you're around, we would love for you to join us. The venue is the amazing Sonic Lab, part of the Sonic Arts Research Centre at Queen's. It'll feature some of the most original thinkers on space and place in Northern Ireland, as well as performances by local musicians and writers. We're incredibly excited to meet our listeners in person.
You can find more information about the live show, including the full list of speakers, and a link to purchase tickets for a very reasonable £5 on the podcast website at placeni.org/The Infinite City. The Infinite City is a production of Place, Northern Ireland's built environment centre. Make sure you subscribe in your podcast app or on iTunes so you can get future episodes as soon as they are released.
If you like what you hear, you can rate us and leave a review on iTunes, which really helps us to reach more people. You can also support the podcast by donating. The link is at placeni.org/The Infinite City.
Tell us what you think via Twitter at Infinite City Pod and on Instagram as The Infinite City.
The Infinite City is produced by Rebecca McCabe and Connor McCafferty for Place, with graphic design by Maria Postanagova and script support from Stuart Gray and Kelsey Hansen. It's supported by Fielding Clegg Bradley Studios and Arts and Business Northern Ireland.